broadcast of Finding Fairways is a production of Blarney Stone Broadcasting and was pre-recorded. Good morning, golfers. Welcome to Finding Fairways here on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne is in studio with my co-host Joe Charles, the director of golf instruction at the Boyne Golf Academy. And Joe, the first thing out of your mouth was, we got to talk about James Piatt. Yeah, just an incredible story. The first golfer ever from the state of Michigan to win the U.S. Amateur. There's so many things to break down. What was the first thing that you thought about as you were watching the coverage?
Well, my first thing is I wish he was a University of Michigan golfer, not a Michigan State golfer. But that's besides the point. But, yeah, I mean, really happy for him. What a cool story. And, you know, you were just kind of mentioning, not a bomber by any means, but, you know, played really steady. He was one, it was kind of an exciting last 36 holes there. He was one up, you know, through 18, but then, you know, kind of lost it and then rallied kind of in those last nine holes, which was, you know, kind of showed some guts. So, you know, really cool story. And, you know, obviously we got to talk about this garbage putter and, what was going on with that as well.
Well, some people are married to their putters no matter what, and I know you know the story better than I do, but where did this putter come from?
From what I've heard is it was his dad's putter, and you know everybody has that kind of bag of throwaway putters and stuff like that, and you know every pure golfer in their garage or in their basement or you know whatever the case may be. So this is an old putter of his dad that I think he said he paid $60 for it when James was playing junior golf, and his dad tried using it. He tried it for 2 weeks, and then hated it. Put it in the in the basement.
Right.
James grabs it and falls in love with the thing. Plays with it with junior golf. Plays through high school. You know, he's obviously in college now using it, and the $60 putter won the U.S. Amateur. So how about that?
Well, on top of that, he won, the GAM of Michigan, the old Horton Smith tournament, I don't know what they renamed it now, at DGC. He's had a great year on top of obviously the biggest win you can have as an amateur.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how, you know, you get into a hot streak, and some of these good players, they get into a hot streak, and, you know, he's been playing some good golf for a while now, so it's not surprising to see him, you know, break onto the scene like this. But you know, you get into a hot streak and you know things start going the right way, and it's amazing what can happen. I remember, you know, not to break away, but you know, this is kind of on the U.S. amateur kick. When I was a kid, I used to caddy at the Kalamazoo Country Club, and a lot of the players would come and play that were playing in the Western Amateur the week before or week after would come play in the Invitational, Kalamazoo Country Club Invitational every year. And a guy by the name of Bubba Dickerson, I don't know if you remember that name.
I do.
He's another U.S. amateur winner. Yeah, from the University of Florida, came and played. And I caddied for the member who played with Bubba, and my best friend caddied for Bubba in the tournament. So they go on, they win, you know, they play well in the Kalamazoo Country Club Invitational. Bubba sticks around and says, hey, do you want to, you know, ask my buddy, do you want to caddy for me at the Western Am over at Point of Woods?
Right.
In Benton Harbor. He wins that, goes on to wins the U.S. Amateur later that year. My buddy caddies for him in that. And then my buddy goes and caddies for him at the Masters, which is 01 when Tiger finishes the Tiger Slam. And as you know, the U.S. Amateur champion gets to play with, this is the year after Tiger won the Tiger Slam. So he
right.
plays with the winner from the year before. So how cool is that for my buddy? You know, and that's just another example of, you know, you get into a hot streak, these college players, they're fearless, and good things can happen.
No doubt about it. In fact, what Piatt made it to the quarterfinals at the Western Amateur this year, another good showing. But the funny thing was, it's funny, James Piatt also had a great showing at the Western Amateur this year, as you were just referencing, the Western Am being one of the biggest events there is. I think he made it to the quarterfinals. But one of the fascinating things about this year's Amateur, Joe, is how highly ranked or lowly ranked, however you want to look at it, Greaser and Piatt was. Piatt was like 86th and Greaser was 81st. ranked amateur in the world. And generally speaking, you don't see that happen in the U.S. amateur very often. You usually have at least one really highly ranked player in the finals. I remember when I was at the U.S. amateur at Oakland Hills, and it was Ricky Barnes, and trying to remember who he beat. But these guys were not very highly ranked to make it all the way to the finals.
Yeah, I mean, that's a blast from the past, Ricky Barnes, right?
Great amateur player.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. So, you know, that's the beauty of match play, right? I mean, that's why, America can't seem to win the Ryder Cup as often as they should with our players being highly ranked. You look at them on paper and, you know, that you think they dominate, but that's the beauty of match play. You know, it's a different animal sometimes. And I think that'll come out in the USAM as well. I think it's just such a cool format. I wish there were more PGA Tour events where it was a match play style format. I think it's, or, you know, and more like maybe team match play style formats on the PGA Tour. I think it's kind of exciting stuff.
Well, I agree with you. Although, you know, it's not like the Europeans are playing a lot of those events either, so I don't know why they have much more proclivity to play a match play format. Although, maybe it goes back to what you and I were talking about at the very beginning, Joe, and that is, you know, you don't have to be a bomber to win in match play. Corey Pavin is a perfect example of that, a great Ryder Cupper, you know, only won a one U.S. Open, but, you know, he knew how to get the ball around. He knew how to frustrate the guy he was playing with, and that's got to have a lot to do with it.
Well, absolutely, and I think, you know, and this Corey Pavin's a good example of this. You got to make putts, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's what the Europeans do so much better than the Americans, especially when it's on their soil. I think they intentionally keep the green speeds a little bit slower, so it's more similar to, you know, the European Tour conditions, whereas our players are used to very, very fast greens. So I think that's one little trick they have, is they try to slow the greens down, and it makes it a little harder for our players to make putts. But how demoralizing can that be if you've got, you know, a guy like DJ or somebody like that who bombs it out there and hits every green, but you've got, you know, one of these, you know, Brandon Grace kind of players, or somebody from Europe who kind of scrapes it around, but then makes a 30-footer to have your 5-footer for birdie. So it's all about momentum, and, you know, the guy making the most putts has the momentum usually in match play.
Yeah, and that's, you know, those are all the examples, you know, the Seve Ballesteros, the Jose Marias, the Sergio Garcias, you know, guys that get up and down from everywhere that, you know, stay in matches. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about in our show today is, as a golf coach and a great teacher, how do you get guys to focus on playing to their strengths, especially when they're playing in, you know, a more important match?
Yeah. So I was actually doing a playing lesson with a guy this morning, and we had a nice little conversation about this. You know, obviously it really helps always at golf, especially when you're in pressure situations, to know your strengths and your weaknesses.
Right.
And to kind of play to those strengths and weaknesses. So, for example, if you're a good wedge player and you're, you know, 230 yards out on a longer par four and you didn't hit a good tee shot, lay up to a good wedge distance and play in from there. You know, things like that, you know, and that's just one of many, many examples. But understanding your own game and playing to your strengths and weaknesses, you know, hitting golf shots that you feel comfortable hitting, not hitting shots that you feel is the right shot to hit. You know, the old cliche goes, play your game. Well, I mean, there's, you know, if you really diagnose that, there's a lot to that. I mean, you have to play your game. You have to hit golf shots that you feel comfortable hitting. You have to hit golf clubs that you feel comfortable hitting. You know, if you're not a good long iron player and you're playing a, you know, tough par three, and there's a bailout to one side of the green that's a little, you know, little, and you can afford to hit it a little short of the hole, there's nothing wrong with playing one club down and kind of playing to the front right of the green on, you know, on a long par three. So, you know, understanding situations like that, super, super important. And then, you know, the second thing I would say is turn a weakness into a strength, right? So, you know, when you are doing training, and this is something that Dean Smith used to do with, you know, we're going to get into basketball now, with Jordan when he was in college, they would, you know, have a little meeting, a little powwow at the end of every season, and talk about the strengths and the weaknesses in his game. And he would work on it the whole offseason. And, you know, the mentality was we were going to turn that weakness into a strength and make the worst part of your game the best part of your game. You do that all of a sudden and you become a pretty darn good player.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit later about how the Boyne Golf Academy can help you improve and spruce up the weak part of your games. But going back to playing to your strengths, especially when you're playing in any kind of event or match that matters, one of the most famous stories I ever heard in golf was when Ben Hogan won the U.S. Open at Oakland Hills. And I don't know if you've ever played there, Joe, but the ninth hole is a brutal par three. It plays over 200 yeah. yards long. It's got a big fishbowl green, and if you're on either one, if the flag is on one side of the upper level and you're on the other or down in the fishbowl, it's almost impossible to two-putt and can three-putt all the time. In that U.S. Open, Hogan laid up all 4 days on a par three. He hit it to yeah. about 70 yards in front of the green, pitched and made par all 4 days there.
Yeah. I remember Hogan having a quote on, you know the 11th hole at Augusta, of course. You know, I think one of the toughest par fours
sure.
in the world. He said, if I hit it on the green, I pulled my shot. And his goal was to, you know, hit it to that bailout area, just, you know, short right of the green every single day and try to get up and down. And, you know, talk about playing to your strengths and weaknesses, right?
Yeah, match for the most part, unless you're super down in a match, is no time for hero shots.
Yeah. I mean, it, definitely in stroke play, it's a different, you know, kind of a different animal. But in match play, the worst thing you can ever do is give somebody a hole. So I'm getting, you know, texts from players. I was actually talking to Johnny. You know, we're going to talk about Gaylord Golf Club. They just had their club championship.
Right.
The other day, and you know, so I'm getting texts from some of those guys, and Justin Kowach, who won the first flight, was telling me about how things went for him. But you know, the worst thing you can do in that scenario is give somebody a hole, right? So this time of year, you've got a lot of people playing match play, playing in club championships. You know, as you said, you got to play to your strengths, not your weaknesses, and never, ever, ever give somebody a hole. And then the other thing is never give up, right?
Right.
You know, a lot of crazy stuff can happen in this game, can't it, Jerry?
Yeah, like I make a birdie once a round. That's crazy enough. when we return here on Finding Fairways, Joe Charles and I will discuss ways of improving your weaknesses. Whether you can or can't attend any of the clinics or have lessons at the Boyne Golf Academy. That's when we return here on Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. It's time to check in with our good friends at carlsgolfland.com. Tim Coyle's on the phone. Tim, you and I were just talking before we got on the air about rangefinders and how much they have evolved in the last few years.
Yeah, they sure have. There's so many, you know, there's a bunch of different brands out there. There's several that you'll be familiar with, you know, from the Bushnells and Garmins to the Loopholes out there. But yeah, they have become a lot easier to use. And, you know, we were talking, they're a lot more point and shoot than they have been ever. And even, you know, depending on what sort of level, I guess, of rangefinder you're looking to get yourself into, you can go for a more basic model. You can even find yourself, you know, over into a more advanced model. There are a lot of them now have, you know, the option to put slope onto it as well. So it'll give you a more accurate reading if you're hitting uphill or downhill. Not legal for tournament play, but a lot of them give you the ability to toggle that off. You have some other models even that some people out there might not be familiar with, from the Bushnell XE rangefinder, where it has, and I'm not kidding when I say this, temperature and barometric pressure built into it with the slope. So it gives you an even more accurate reading. Where you have the Garmin Z82 model, which has been super popular, which, you know, has if you're familiar with some of the wearable devices, you know, it has in the viewfinder overview of the hole you're on. So you can see distances to different hazards and whatnot. So they've gotten pretty high tech. So, but for the people out there that are looking for something more point and shoot, they've definitely made it a lot easier for those folks out there.
Well, plus if you were watching the U.S. Amateur, James Piatt was using his. I guess he had the right equipment because he's the first Michigan winner ever of the U.S. Amateur.
Yeah, that's so cool to see him win. Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, if he's anything like me, you know, I bounce around, and I know he's played in a bunch of different events around the state here and nationally. When I, you know, when I'm in an unfamiliar environment and a different course, rangefinder is my go-to for sure.
Yeah, it's just another reason why you need to go to carlsgolfland.com, take a look at the rangefinders selections, and find the one that's right for you. And if you don't like it, you can send it back to Carl's for free.
Free returns, absolutely. If it's, you unbox it and it's just not for you, or you know, you're shooting it around the house, just give us a shot. We'll make sure to get you taken care of.
There you go. Thanks, Tim, and happy shooting.
Yeah, there you go.
Fairways here on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne in studio on the phone with my co-host Joe Charles, the director of golf instruction at the Boyne Golf Academy. And literally going back to our conversation and golf instruction, Joe, so we're at that time of year now where your students have played a lot of golf, should have made improvements in a lot of the areas they concentrated on. Now is the time where they can help come back to you and go, well, this worked well, this worked well, this worked well, but I still can't chip, or I really got to work on my chipping.
Yeah, I mean, the short game, you know, a lot of the times, you know, especially this time of year, the short game can kind of make or break your game. You know, I can't tell you how many players we have just pure in it right now because they have been working on their game. But they, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating if you're hitting the ball a lot better, but you're not scoring better, right?
Right.
So, and that can kind of, you know, wears on you a little bit. And that, you know, that kind of goes back to that conversation we were having earlier about match play, right? So, you know, we do hear that, you know, from time to time, and you know, we like to kind of actually map out practice routines for players, and you know, that's where it can actually be really, really helpful for people to actually, you know, keep track of their stats on their scorecard. And, you know, you start to keep track of your stats and compile the data over time, and you start to realize, gosh, I'm hitting 70-something percent of my fairways. I'm hitting 13 or 14 greens per round. Well, geez, that's the same as what PGA Tour players do. Why do they shoot so much better scores for me? Oh, maybe it's because I'm averaging 37 putts per round, you know. So you start to figure that kind of stuff out, and it actually motivates you to want to work on, you know, your short game a little bit more. When you can, you know, you can't hide from the numbers, right?
Well, you know, and that's the way golf is trending more and more. We've talked so much about the TrackMan range out at the Boyne golf facility, and how much that data can help you. When you combine that with your actual stats, then it's going to give you a really clear picture. I mean, if you play enough golf, you know what your strengths and weaknesses are, or at least you should. And so when you come back to Joe Charles or J.R. Roth or whoever you're working with and present that, it should be pretty easy to map out what kind of drills and what kind of practice routine you need to fill out that your complete golf resume.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do when we're, you know, we start every golf lesson with an interview, and we, you know, we kind of trying to get some feedback from players about, you know, what their golf ball is doing, you know. So in terms of full swing, you know, what's your miss? Okay, when you hit it good, how does the ball curve? When you hit it bad, how does the ball curve? Is the ball going high or is the ball going low? Do you tend to miss it more in the left rough? Do you tend to miss it more in the right rough? And, you know, all of that information is really, really valuable. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes people will have, you know, a different shot shape tendencies on the driving range than they will on the golf course. And that's because, you know, for many different reasons. I don't know if you've ever experienced a different ball flight on the range than the golf course. Have you, Jerry?
Well, you've actually seen it, Joe. I did pay you to erase all that video, didn't I?
You know, I actually have it saved. If any of our viewers or listeners want, I can be bribed with Jerry Coyne footage if they, if they're interested.
Yeah, if you're depressed about your game, contact Joe Charles for the video. You'll feel much better right away. But, yeah, well, there's nothing worse. I mean, getting into instruction and problems, a two-way miss is brutal. So at least as you kind of bringing this up, what is the first thing you attack when that's happening, Joe? When, you know, half your shots are going left and half your shots are going right.
Yeah, that's a terrible feeling to stand on a tee box and not know, you know, where you're going to miss it.
Right.
You know, we always talk about having a one-way miss. You know, you can't have, you know, golf is not a game of perfect. You can't be perfect every time, but you have to have a consistent miss, and you have to have your misses have to be a little better than other players. I used to work, you know, when I was a young man, I worked at Medalist Golf Club down in Florida, which was Norman's spot.
Yep.
And it was actually kind of a cool time to be working there because it was right after his divorce, and so he was actually living at the golf course in one of the cottages. So inevitably, you know, he would be kind of hanging out in the men's locker room where we had a cool bar and stuff like that in there, and he would tell stories about the good old days and stuff like that. And you know, one night we're in there and we're kind of looking up, and there's this big great white shark right above the bar that he caught on a boat, you know, fishing, and there's all of these framed magazine covers from the 90s when he was the number one player in the world for God knows how many weeks.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, guys, when I was kicking everybody's butt back in the day, and I'm not even going to try to do an Australian accent for you, he said, I hit about 2 perfect shots per round. Everything else was a miss of some kind. Think about that. 2 perfect shots per round, and he's the number one player in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that just goes to show how good his misses were relative to some other people.
At that time, he was a +8, Joe. That means... I don't think he was a +8 at the Medalist, but that was his handicap. He was a +8, so he gives a scratch, 4 aside, just heading out to the first tee. But, you know, especially driving the golf ball, Butch Harmon still says to this day he's the single greatest driver of the golf ball that he's ever seen for length accuracy.
It's actually pretty cool. In our gears lab here at Boyne, we have Norman on gears with his avatar swinging a driver. So it's pretty cool for people to be able to see their swing, and then we can put Norman's, you know, 1991 driver swing when he's dominating, and, you know, say, okay, here's what his hips are doing, here's what your hips are doing, and here's how it's different. This is why he's so much better than you, or one of the reasons why he's so much better than you. So there's usually more than one reason.
I was going to say, I'd be careful with that because most people would just quit.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, going back to your question, though, I mean, having a one-way miss, super, super important. You know, the PGA Tour tracks data now, you know, with shot length. And you can, it's pretty cool because you can go on PGAtour.com and actually look at the leaders in different categories in terms of, you know, greens and regulation percentage, putts, you know, shots gained putting, you know, all this different stuff.
Right.
One of the cool stats that I like to look at is, there's two of them. One is percentage of balls in the left rough and percentage of balls in the right rough. And what that basically is saying, if this player misses the fairway, what percentage of the time is it going to be in the left rough versus the right rough? So I think, you know, one of the years that I was, you know, when this first came out, Zach Johnson was the leader in the percentage of balls in the left rough category. And, you know, obviously he's well known as being a pretty good straight driver of the golf ball, but hits a little baby draw every time. So
right.
Zach kind of aims down the middle of the fairway, and he knows he's either going to hit it right perfectly right down the middle, or he's going to hit a little, just a touch too much draw, and it's going to be barely in the left rough. well, all of a sudden, you know, you can play golf and score pretty well if you have that kind of mindset.
Yeah. When we get back here on Finding Fairways, we're going to talk about how to make that decision to eliminate one side of the golf course and make your game a little bit more accurate, a little bit more consistent. That's coming up here next on Finding Fairways with Joe Charles from the Boyne Golf Academy, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Welcome back to Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne in studio with Joe Charles, the Director of Golf Instruction at the Boyne Golf Academy. And Joel, we were talking last segment about two-way misses, and it seems to me that it used to be most guys wanted to draw the ball for distance, but now it's come pretty much full circle, and the desired miss is going to be on the right side of the golf course. Most people hitting power fades or baby fades.
Yeah, you know, the old saying goes, you can talk to a fade, but a hook won't listen, right? So, especially with this newer technology, I mean, the ball's going so far. In the past, you had to kind of hit a little rope hook knuckleball to kind of get as much distance as you could with those high-spinning, you know, Bellotta golf balls, Titleist professional golf balls, that kind of stuff. You kind of had to get it turning over to get that ball out there as far as you can. Now, you know, these guys are hitting it so far, and the equipment is spinning the ball so much less that you can hit a fade, and the ball will go as far as you need it to. So, you know, you start seeing guys like, you know, Dustin Johnson's a perfect example of this. He, when he was earlier, in, you know, younger in his career, had a bit of a, I would call it a two-way miss, where he got the club a little too far to the inside and he could either hit a block to the right or, you know, double cross it and hook it to the, you know, left of the fairway.
Right.
You know, he got with Butch and he started playing that little pull cut shot. You know, the rest is history, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even going back in the day, Hogan is the first one that always wanted to eliminate the left side of the golf course. He fought a hook for many years, and that's where Power Golf and all his golf instruction books kind of came around to starting to have people play a fade. And then when Nicklaus played the fade, that kind of cemented that idea.
Yeah. The Five Principles, which is the book you're referring to there with Hogan.
Yeah.
You know, for guys who slice the, you know, I actually hate some players reading that book because, you know, a lot of golfers do, unfortunately, still slice the ball quite a bit.
Right.
If you, you know, for anybody listening out there, if you slice the ball, The Five Principles by Ben Hogan is the worst book you could possibly read because yeah. What did Hogan want to do? He weakened his grip
right.
As much as he possibly could.
Yep.
He would do, you know, just about everything he could to, as you just said, not hook the ball. So if you're, you know, if you're slicing the ball or battling, you know, a shot that curves to the right for a right-handed player, it, you know, the Five Principles is going to make you do it even worse. So, but that being said, you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the best players of all time are predominantly, you know, faders of the golf ball. You know, Nicklaus, obviously. I think when Tiger was playing some really good golf, he hit a little cut out there. A lot of really good players, you know, and that's for a few different reasons. One, the, you know, you can hit it higher and softer into longer, you know, with longer shots into
right.
Greens and hold greens a lot easier, whereas a draw is going to be a little bit tougher to do that. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, a nice, solid, high fade is, for a really good player, usually the go-to shot.
Yeah, it's certainly more controllable and makes the outcome more predictable. So without you having somebody on the range at the Boyne Golf Academy, what's the easiest way to start bringing that ball into a fade and not a slice?
The most important thing is understanding, you know, first of all, what are your tendencies? So if you tend to slice the ball and you're, you know, trying to get away from slicing it so much, we would actually try to teach you to have the ability to hit a draw. And,
right.
you know, usually what we say is if you have the ability to do that, we're usually going to meet each other in the middle and you're going to hit straight golf shots, or at least you're going to not slice it quite as much. And the opposite is true for somebody who hooks the ball. We try to teach them how to fade the ball a little bit more so that, you know, they have the ability to get rid of that hook when, you know, when things start going bad. The first thing that I always go to right away is the grip. The grip is the most important thing that controls your ability to control that club face. So we do a quick wrist and forearm check to make sure that your mobility is good in your wrists and your forearms. Make sure you're, you know, flexing and extending your wrists, hinging them well. You know, there's a lot of things that happens there that controls the way that club face is moving.
Right.
Once we do that, we put you in a grip that suits that ball, you know, that ball flight. So a lot of people think that there's one perfect grip and that's the grip that everybody should use. And that's just not true. Everybody's grip is going to be a little bit unique based on how big their hands are, you know, their mobility level, what their desired ball flight is. You know, there's a lot of things that go into it. So grip first. From there, we try to give them a perception or a feel of the direction the club head is moving in. So now we're talking about, you know, we just talked about the club face. Now we're talking about the path the club is traveling on. So the path that the club is traveling on is what controls the side spin of the golf ball, okay? So generally speaking, if you swing the club from out to in, so for example, if you're a right-handed player, if you swing the club in the direction or the exit path of the golf club is to the left of your target, that's going to put clockwise side spin on that golf ball, or
right.
It's going to tilt the axis of the spin to the right. So that golf ball is going to want to curve to the right. And vice versa, if you tend to exit the club more to the right of your target, that's going to make that ball kind of want to curve more to the left. And that's, Jerry, why golf is so hard. You'd think it'd be the opposite, right? You'd think, you know, you swing right, the ball goes right. Well, it's actually the opposite of that, and that's because there's side spin on that sucker when it's flying.
And the best way to know that is from your divots. You even see PGA Tour pros looking down at their divots all the time when they make a bad shot, just to pretty much confirm what was wrong with that strike.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the direction that the divot is pointed obviously shows you the path. Another thing that I look at in the divots is the shape of the divot. You know, generally we like rectangular divots, whereas if they're pointy on one side, that can mean that either the toe or the heel is digging into the turf a little bit more. That tells us a little more about the angle of attack. It can also tell us a little bit about the closure rate of the club face, how much that face is rotating through impact. So you're absolutely right, Jerry. The divot tells a lot and gives you a lot of feedback, no question.
Yep. Going back to what you and I were talking about a little bit off air, about the medalist and how difficult a golf course that was Norman's first design. Not that I want to get into the particulars. I know you played there a bunch and you know how tough it is. But the USAM was played on the toughest golf course, generally speaking, in America. They always say if you need to hold a U.S. Open in an emergency, just hold it at Oakmont. We saw a few examples of that, even under soggy conditions, Joe, about missing your spot on a difficult golf course and how badly your ball will end up. Medalist has the same problem.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you go to Medalist and you can get short-sighted. There's this, for those of you who aren't familiar with this golf course, this is a golf course that's in Hobe Sound, Florida, and there's probably 15 tour players who are members there, you know, all the guys who live on Jupiter Island or who live, you know, kind of in that area, Tiger, of course, Ricky Fowler, DJ, all these guys are members at Medalist. It's by far the coolest club championship you'll ever want to play in when you've got Ricky Fowler versus, you know, whoever playing. And those guys will actually play in some of the member events, which is pretty neat.
No doubt.
But going back to that golf course, it really is tough. I mean, there's a lot of tough golf courses in that area. Old Marsh Golf Club's another one that's really, really tough. What I used to say and what I used to think when I worked there it can make you a better player, right? You know, a lot of people think that tour players spend hours and hours and hours on the driving range just beating golf ball after golf ball. And that's really not true. One of the things I noticed when I worked at Medalist was the tour players would practice and warm up out on the driving range, but they went out on the golf course and would just practice hitting golf shots all over the golf course and practice dropping balls in different spots and hitting shots. And that's really more realistic practice. So a lot of, you know, sometimes mulligans kind of get a bad rap in golf, but tour players hit more mulligans than anybody you know. And that's because they're utilizing those to kind of practice when they're out there. And that's what that was one of the biggest things that I noticed when I was there.
That's a fantastic topic. We're going to circle back to that in our next episode, Joe. When we return here on Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com, talking to Joe about the proper way to practice and how to practice during a round of golf. Back to Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne in studio with my co-host this week, Joe Charles, who's the director of golf instruction at the Boyne Golf Academy. Joe, you were mentioning in the last segment that especially at the Medalist, that had so many PGA Tour pros as members, but pros are always going to warm up for a good 45 minutes before they play, but they did more practicing on the golf course than on the range.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you'd watch those guys, and it was pretty cool at that time in my life because I was in my early 20s and I'm, you know, working at this golf course. And, you know, some of these guys, you know, at the time, Jesper Parnevik, Freddie Jakobsen, a lot of those, you know, Swedish guys would hang out there. And I would get to, like, you know, Per Ulrich Johansson was another blast from the past guy who was a member there. Richard S. Johnson, James Driscoll was there when I was there, and he was practicing all the time. But, you know, when those guys would practice, you know, you'd see, and the superintendent would hate it, right? So, because they'll drop six golf balls, hit them all from the exact same spot into you know, different holes. And, you know, you go out and play later on in the day after they've been out there, you can see where they've been. You know, all of a sudden there's 10 divots all in one spot. And you're like, gosh, was there a scramble, eight-man scramble going on out here? Oh, no. You know, Parnevik was out here taking some monster divots all from one spot, you know, and he wouldn't leave till he hit a perfect shot on the fourth hole or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Right.
That's a great way to practice. You know, it's more realistic. You're constantly hitting different golf clubs. How many times do you get on the driving range and you hit 45 seven irons in a row? And then you try to switch to your driver and you hit the first driver like crap.
Right.
Well, that's probably because you're so used to swinging that seven iron. You know, it's not realistic.
Yeah, as I mentioned to you off air, because of my schedule and how busy I get, I don't play nearly as much as I would like. So I do spend a fair amount of time on the range. And our buddy JT Odd, who's the head pro at Gaylord Golf Club, told me earlier this year that I was messing my own game up by practicing so much and I needed to play more and get the opportunity to play some golf in the afternoon on some weekdays and be able to hit a number of different balls so you weren't holding anybody up. And it is a better way to think about golf and not swing or, you know, what happened wrong in that particular moment.
Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed, and this is kind of getting back to what's going on in the golf business, see some private clubs closing. People, you know, some of the, you know, the newer generations, the millennials and stuff like that, they're not as apt to want to join a country club and pay that initiation fee when they, different websites out there where they can get a, you know, round for $35.
Sure.
But I will counter that with, there is a nice, that is a nice aspect to be able to not pay to play golf, you know, because you've already paid your membership. You can go out there for four holes in the evening after work. It's not as busy of a golf course because it is a private experience. And you can kind of, like you just said, work your way around the golf course, play a few holes, hit a few shots. It's a really, really good way to practice. I encourage players. We see players all the time. They get a little nervous out on the golf course, or they're playing with new people, or maybe they're working on a swing change, and they don't feel comfortable taking that swing change to battle for the, you know, $2 NASA on Saturday morning. Well, I tell them, you know, the best thing you can do is, you know, go and play around golf by yourself and practice that swing change out on the golf course and practice hitting four different shots off the tee on the seventh hole. And that's a really good kind of transitional way to kind of get used to being on the course and be able to, you know, take that new movement to battle.
Yeah, you know, it's one way every once in a while, especially when I'm working on my short game and you're trying to hit different shots with your wedge, all of a sudden I'll get stuck somewhere and I'll hit six or seven shanks or those real wild slices that'll scare the crap out of you. You know what I mean. We call it the Las Vejos because we don't want to say it in English.
You don't want to say the S word.
No,
The S word. Don't even say it on air right now.
Yeah, it's like cancer. My mom used to whisper that. She's got cancer. But that doesn't happen when I do that out on the golf course. So, it's one of those interesting things when you're more focused on, okay, how am I going to flight the ball into this green? You know, you've got the different humps or whatever, and you're paying more attention to exactly what to do instead of just, like, pounding a perfect wedge, then that never comes into play when I'm playing. So, you know, that's kind of like a little preaching for not practicing so much for playing a little bit more.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, sometimes you get, especially when you're working on your wedges, you know, you hit too many wedges in a row and you start, you know, because it is a short golf club, there is a lot of loft on it. It promotes a sharper, you know, more descending blow. You know, the angle of attack steepens a bit. And you hit too many wedges in a row and that angle of attack gets sharper and sharper and steeper and steeper. And that's a pure recipe for hitting the hosel, the old S word that you were just talking about. So, you know, kind of mixing it up, hitting a few, and you can do this on the driving range too. You know, what I'll have players do, if you can't get out on the golf course and play, when you are on the range and, you know, you only have 40 minutes or something like that, play a, you know, kind of a fake round on the driving range.
Right.
So hit a, you know, kind of visualize a fairway, hit a driver, put your driver down, hit a 7-iron. Oh, that's a little left of the green. You know, now I have to hit a 20-yard pitch shot. And, you know, kind of work your way around the golf course. And you can even, you know, take it one step further, grab a scorecard, you know, from the golf shop, and you can actually play, you know, a lot of the holes will actually have pictures of the holes on the scorecard. You could kind of almost play a fake round of golf right on there. That's one of the things that we're super excited about here at Boyne with our TrackMan range. Right on the range here, you can actually play golf. So the cool thing about that is, you know, you've got the app going right on the platform in front of you, and you're playing, you know, the Hills course here at Boyne Highlands. And it's really good practice because you're hitting different shots every single time. You get a score at the end of the day. You kind of have a indicator to see how well you played, if you played well or not so well. And, we're coming up with different ways to practice where, like you said, you're not just beating ball after ball for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, no, I've used that TrackMan, and it actually shows you where your next shot is, so you don't even have to visualize it. You could see that you've left a 40-yard wedge shot to the pin, and it's a great application. With just a few minutes left, Joe, I'll ask you, so you got any thoughts on who might end up winning the FedEx Cup?
East Lake is always, it's a cool venue for a tournament.
Yeah.
You know, you've got these really good players. I think, I think John Rahm is just one of the hottest players this year. I would not count him out. Usually I would say DJ, but DJ never seems to play well at East Lake. His record isn't really that good there. But, I kind of like John Rahm. What about you, Jerry?
Hideki Matsuyama.
Okay. All right.
He showed me a lot, even though he didn't win the gold medal. That was so much pressure, and he is such a good ball striker, and he's got the distance. I mean, Morikawa's good. There's a lot of guys that could win it, but Hideki Matsuyama, I think, really turned the page to become the player that a lot of people have been talking about him for a while. It's going to be good theater, at least.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what his menu is at the Masters Champions Dinner next year. Huh?
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get around to it next year. Joe Charles, thanks for joining us from the Boyne Golf Academy here on Finding Fairways. As we like to say, find a fairway of your own, stick a peg in the ground, and pound it down the middle. We'll be back with you next week here, thanks to carlsgolfland.com. It's time to check in with our good friends at Boyne Golf. Ken Griffin's on the line. And Ken, we've been in the midst of some of the most amazing weather after the rain we had a couple weeks ago. Now the golf courses look like heaven, like a field of dreams.
Oh, been in great shape the last couple weeks. You know, even this weekend, we got a great weekend ahead of us. A little bit of rain, but that's coming Saturday night. And the forecast for the next couple of weeks is promising through the end of August.
Yeah, it's so delightful. And we're looking forward to our favorite season of fall golf. But now we just got some very strange news that you wanted our listeners to know something about.
Well, yeah, it was unfortunate news Friday for our friends in Ontario. You know, the borders are closed through at least September 21st now. They extended it a month, and, you know, we feel bad for them. It's been a rough 2 years for our Canadian friends. You know, they've been holding out that they could start playing in the U.S. this weekend, but that's not going to be the case. But what may be bad news for Canadian listeners is great news for your listeners that are visiting Northern Michigan within the next month. Typically, it's a very busy time for us with Canadian visitors on our courses, and now those tee times and rooms are being canceled.
Yeah, so if we go on the BoyneGolf.com right now, you'll see tee times that weren't available just a few days ago back open.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, as you said, just visit BoyneGolf.com. You'll have availability for tee times and rates and information on lodging and packages. So things that have not been available now probably are.
Yeah, and like you said, just a perfect time to be playing golf here in Northern Michigan. Long summer days into the evenings, cool nights. It's just perfect.
Some very cool sunsets at night now.
Yeah, I got you that. And we haven't talked about it in a long time, but you have the photo and the walking tours of Bay Harbor, even if you're not playing golf.
The Cliff View Cart Tours, correct.
Fantastic stuff, and it's all on BoyneGolf.com. Ken, thanks for joining us. We'll see you on the fairway.
Thanks, Jerry.